Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
It's a terrible thing when you have kids and you see them be embarrassed. And you think it's crushing. It's like seeing them being physically hurt. Because you think that's one, you know, if childhood is 1,000 lights, it's one of them that turned off, you know. And when you become an adult, all your lights are off, you know. So the job as a musician is to keep as many of them on as possible, even though it might result in humiliation.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map. I was going to say, how do you cope with the band that comes in that thinks, you know, this is the band, this is what we do, and we need you to produce us? Do you liberate them?
I try, and the first thing I try and do is not think of people having, it's not a factory line where you're putting on the tires of the car, you're doing the windscreen, is to not have stations. Like, this is your area. Mm. So everybody can do whatever they want is the first thing. And, you know, when we started at first, bring it back to us again, talking about ego. You know, we talked about it, you guys both being drummers, but you're not, it's very reductive to think about you both as drummers.
Right.
I mean, drums are my favorite instrument. But, you know, you do other stuff. And great things happen when, you know, people try other things. You know, I was listening to a band the other day that my daughter sent me. Maher, the Japanese guitar band. I can't remember what they're called now. It's a record with Bill Wells and this Japanese band. And the record's called Osaka Bridge. And it's horn players who can't really play. They'd probably be insulted if I sing it, but it's all out of tune. But it's an amazing, amazing record. And they're trying something that they're not that comfortable with. They're playing instruments that they're not that comfortable with. And instantly, I fell in love with it. And it's like, it's flawed and it's beautiful. But once you start getting people, this is my station, I'm really good at this, and I don't want to do anything else, you suddenly get into documenting their brilliance rather than their discovery. So I have worked with bands. There's one band recently who their A&R person sent me a request that I wanted to work with them, and I said, no, I don't. And I gave them like 10 to 15 points of why I wouldn't. I wouldn't usually be that blunt, but I decided to be as blunt and open as I could because I liked the person who sent it to me, and I wanted them to know that I was considering it, and that's the reason why I wouldn't do it. And it was a really brutal email I sent. And he sent it to the band, and he said, the band want to talk to you.
Oh.
So I thought, wow, that's something.
Yeah.
And then I went to Nashville to work with them. And I tried to do all the things that I said we should do. And then they just didn't feel comfortable with it at all. So I've had, you know, in the last few years, I've had a lot of experiences that are similar. So I kind of stopped producing for that reason. I just, you know, I came up with The Cure and The Banshees as my favorite groups. I'm not just saying that, but they were my favorite groups. And the thing I loved about them so much, it was pivotal in my musical my understanding of music was that every record that was done by the groups that you were in were completely different from the last one. And the only comparison I can find is peak Kanye or Kendrick Lamar, where they are willing to alienate their current fan base to do what they want to do. And the fan base generally stay with them because you are documenting discovery within yourself. And you can hear this tangible excitement from the artist that we're throwing out the rule book we had last year that, yes, that worked, but we're doing something else now, and then we're going to do something else. And I miss that, and that's what I expect from music, is from artists, is like keeping on, I'm going to try something else that I'm excited about. And I don't really hear it in a lot of new bands, because I think they're too conscious of brand and what the expectation is.
Right.
So it becomes this kind of expansionist capitalist idea of music, and not like in a Coldplay way where we're just going to get bigger and, you know, it's like Cherry Coke and Coke, Vanilla Coke and stuff like that. And bands didn't do that before. So that's what I miss. And that's why I can't really do records like that anymore. But what was it with you guys? Like, why was there an active, did you have discussions say, we're not going to do that next time, we're going to do something else? Or was it just natural?
Sort of, we did, because I was thinking while you were talking, when we'd made the first album, which was basically a whole live set that we'd played for 3 years, and we just recorded it, and we had no idea what we were doing. We just like, okay, record it. And at the end of that, we're like, yeah, that's not really quite who we are. And so when we come to do 17 Seconds, we told Chris Parry, you know, God love him, that, you know, he better not come into the studio, because, you know, we didn't want to do the same thing. And his office was right in the same building as the studio. So he came in maybe about once every couple of weeks. He'd sort of sneak in late one night and have a listen. But, you know, that was really a genius idea by him, because he left us to our own devices. And I can remember sitting in there, like, listening to every take that we did of stuff and sitting there and really thinking about it. And we made a point where we decided, okay, we can't just put ourselves into one place, like you were saying about stations and stuff. And we all swapped instruments. We all said, like, okay, let's just, you know, I'll play a bit of guitar, you play some drums, you know, put Robert on drums and play some something else and mix it up. And, you know, we liked some of the things we did that way. Some of them sounded really good and some of them sounded not so great. But the idea was that was a liberating leap. It helped us leap and see it in a different way. So therefore, when Robert was doing the vocals, I could sit there and go, okay, how about this? How about that? Let's try something there. You know, my mind was not just like, oh, I'm the drummer and that's what I do, and I can't have a thought about anything else. And it filled it more. And that's really what happened again when we got together. That's what happened. It was remarkable for me to feel that power again, because after so many years, and you're right, after so many years you get into a thing where you think, okay, this is what we do, this is the formula, and that kind of kills everything most of the time, you know, it just stops it dead.
You know, the question you always get asked is, what do you like best, recording studio or live?
Yeah.
And we like both, but there's no easy answer, because we're looking for live in the studio somehow. And yet you've got a whole new environment and a place to work. When you form a band, you're not thinking of recording studio. You're thinking of getting a bunch of songs together, be them cover versions of somebody else's songs or your own efforts at writing, and really you're trying to get a gig and seeing how long you can do it for. And then somewhere you get your first album session, and so you get the chance to record all the songs you've been playing live for maybe a year or maybe three or maybe more.
Right.
And then a year after having toured that album of new songs or the old songs, you're asked to record a bunch of new songs for the second album. I think I joined a band that had just imploded on its second album. And right. That album, which was they were going to tour America with, didn't. I don't think it even got released in America. So it was going to be the first American release. Scream, first album. Join Hands, second. And then it came to pretty much like, it wasn't, if I can remember correctly. So the tour limped home, you know, and then it was like, let's write some new songs. So Susie and Severin went off and wrote stuff in a demo studio, which they probably hadn't done ever. Because they'd written as a band, I imagine, because I wasn't there. And so they fleshed out a lot of ideas with a beatbox, and it was like a peculiar kind of, you know, Roland Compey rhythm beatbox that Roxy Music would have been using on the Dance Away years. Right. And so it changed the sound straight away from, you know, Kenny Morris wanting to be like Mo Tucker, or, you know. And then suddenly you got this kind of sultry, simmering little, boom, boom, you know, little rumbas going on then. Yeah. And Severin playing some bass, more melodic bass, because it was tuned. There was like some kind of hint at top line melody. And when by the time I got in there, you know, there was a lot of stuff all fleshed out, but it was a lot of beatbox. But if there were tracks to be written, I remember picking up Severin, a bass that was lying around and a couple of MXR flanges and playing those, having played right. one string bass. And a song is born, but no talk, no discussion. Where are we going? What's the direction? What do we look like? Who are we? Those things came along once we'd established ourselves as a new band. Right. Then you were, suddenly along comes, yeah, but you don't do that, do you? Why is the marimba on this record when you use that on The Creatures, don't you? Because it's funny how you're allowed to do certain things in certain places. And that's the kind of discussion that you think a band would be healthy for. You know, you would think it would be healthy to have these discussions. But you're saying, Jack, it's like when you start, you don't have the time for those discussions.
Well, there's more at stake, I think. You know, it's very easy for me to push a band, and I've done it before. You know, why don't we try do this? And I don't have to stand on stage and sell the thing. So there's a risk of humiliation. And I think what happens as you get older is it's a terrible thing when you have kids and you see them be embarrassed. And you think it's like it's crushing. It's like seeing them being physically hurt, because you think that's one, you know, if you have if childhood is 1,000 lights, it's one of them that turned off, you know. And when you become an adult, all your lights are off, you know. So the job as a musician is to keep as many of them on as possible, even though it might result in humiliation. Like, it's doing things knowing that it might be a disaster.
Yeah.
And interestingly, people like to see the tightrope walker. The reason why I don't really watch horses do show jumping is because it's not that exciting. You know, I know they're rehearsed. And it's going through the motions. I saw Beyonce at Coachella, and I didn't need to be there for the show to work. It had been rehearsed within, you know, inches of its life. So it didn't need me. And you kind of want to see people taking a risk. And that's, as you progress through your band career, you take less risks because the potential for failure is too great. And then, you know, you have management and label saying, this worked the last time. So let's do it again. And so you start making enough changes to appease everybody, you know, yourself, but they're not radical. And I think both you guys got kickstarted by validation on radical ideas, whether it's the drumming on the Slits album Cut or the crazy experimentation of 17 Seconds, which was a crazy record. And then you did Kaleidoscope, you think, well, okay, well, we'll go further next time. We'll go further because the crazy of the idea, it seems they're not radical isn't less accessible. It seems to be now, but it's not. Radical is its own hook.
Yeah.
And weird is its hook. But now the reason why rock and roll is failing miserably is because it just wants to be liked. You know, the radical takes. I mean, there's a few, Alt J came out and that was kind of radical. But then, you know, those two kids on YouTube who were pretending to write an Alt J song, that's as good as Alt. Alt J haven't taken the leap from 17 Seconds to Pornography.
Right.
Or, you know, they just haven't made that leap where I kind of know what they're going to do. So the lights in my brain aren't igniting. I wonder what they're going to do. Like I got from, say, going on the Kendrick record to, from, you know, Pimp a Butterfly to Damn and then to, you know, the latest one. They're all, it's surprising. You kind of want to keep up. This is like, what the hell is he going to do next? And that's what I miss from bands. And so the actual point of bands isn't quite there. You don't have that crazy dynamic where heads are butting together and you're a gang, so you feel powerful enough to try the experiments. Individuals don't have it in the same way. So fans are just trying to please the brand. They're not pushing each other, and there's not this internal competition. A lot of times, a lot of the bands that, again, I liked were like Public Image and Metal Box. They were three individual characters.
Yeah.
We're having a fight, an internal fight. You can hear it.
Yeah.
And they're trying to outdo each other. And usually the energy force in a lot of bands now is one person. And they're dragging everybody along. And, you know, you can't distinguish who's drumming on this because it's just kind of formulaic, generic drumming. Whereas, say, on your stuff, I knew it was you playing, always. And I knew... You know, Block Party were probably one of the last bands that I could tell who, what band they were in, or maybe, you know, pretty much them. I can't think of that many where I could tell just by listening. Oh, that's the drummer from Block Party, because they all have very, very distinct characters. You know, it's almost like the bebop people when you have Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker playing in the same band or whatever. They're all people who are helping each other, but you know they're having a fight.
Yeah,
and they're gonna. You know, I'm going to shout like the Beatles did it. Good bands do it. And that's rather than one person being the life force and everyone just running along aside them. So, I was hoping that we'd achieve some of that with us, the record. And I think we did, you know, it was like...
Yeah, definitely.
Just to try and find out what we were made of. And also, another thing which I really wanted to look at was picking up dropped batons, you know, and remembering certain things that should have, I think, Lal, you said to me, your son had said when we were recording that a lot of bands that he knew were taking one idea from a band that they liked and just really
right
looking at it in the microscope and seeing what happens if we go deeper into this, almost like a Rothko painting where we're just going to take one color and just look at it. So there was a bits of that I wanted to really explore with certain ideas that you guys had that haven't been explored enough, maybe, in some ways.
You just reminded me of one of the things I always liked, and I feel that we did this with the album we just made. It's like at the beginning, in my time, you know, with The Cure and that, Robert would always say at the beginning of a tour or the beginning of the records, the next record, this is the last record we're doing. We're not doing any more after this. This is the last tour we're ever doing. We're not doing anything more after this. And he would sincerely mean it. Never happened, but he would sincerely mean it. And it had the habit of focusing, you're like, okay, if this is going to be the last thing I'm going to do, what am I going to do? So it focused your mind into making you do things that you wouldn't sit there and say, okay, well, we need this song because that was like that song on the last record that people liked. We're not going to do a single the same way because it was like, I mean, you know, I think about that when we finished Pornography and the next thing we put out was like, you know, Let's Go to Bed, which was like, you know, more than 180. It was like 360 degrees from what we'd done before. But it was kind of exciting at the same time. I mean, it was a tremendous calamity. After Pornography, the band fell apart completely, but then it all fell back together again.
Well, that's an interesting thing as well with that. You know, also, like, with rock and roll, I remember dancing to that song in a club in Dublin as a kid, and
I don't know if people dance to rock and roll anymore, do they? I mean, it's like a dance club, and rock and roll has a different purpose, but the body music aspects of these things aren't explored much anymore, you know? I used to go dancing to that, and I loved it. And also, you know, I think I was dancing to Primary too, though, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing about it was people would try and put us in a little box as well. And if they'd ever heard, you know, like Robert had this box of cassettes that came with you on tour, right? And Robert's box of cassettes that he would play after the show in his bedroom, you know, if it was Club Smith that night or not Club Tolhurst or whatever, he'd bring this box of cassettes out and it had all kinds of stuff on, like really, you know, different things that most of the people, not most of the people, but some of the people that liked at the time would think, why is he like that? Why has he got that in there? You know, and it was like so different. And Simon used to say to me, you know, pop's not a dirty word, Lol. It's not a dirty word. I like some pop. I love, you know, he loved, I mean, he spent the whole of the tour walking around quoting Kate Bush lyrics. I remember that, like for the whole of Christmas time, you know, he was just walking around dressed as Father Christmas, quoting her lyrics. You know, there's different things that make it up. And it's the other thing is, I always found it strange that people expect bands to recreate what they did before, just a slightly different way. You know, that's the only artists in the world that you expect to do that. You know, nobody looks at a painter or a poet and says, give me something exactly the same as last time, but just change a few words or a few strokes, you know. It's like they're all allowed to evolve. And for me, that's the only thing that I can really think about, because this album that we just done is evolved so much that people are going to know it's come where it comes. They're going to know where it comes from, but it's so different that it's fresh and exciting. You know, it wouldn't be fresh and exciting to do what we did before again to me. Not really, you know, it would be. Yeah, I mean, there are tribute bands that do just as good a version of those kind of things, and perhaps they should do it, you know. But I don't think I want to do it.
There's a few out there now.
There's a few out there.
I've had the dubious pleasure of hearing My Beats play by somebody else very recently, and it struck me that what we've also got on this album is guest vocalists. Do you think that release from the band, because most of the people who are singing on the album have been in bands for a good 10 years, if not longer, and if you like, the caricatures, the credentials, the way that things come together is well established. Have you found maybe in other collaborations as well, where you put somebody out of not just the comfort zone, but the familiarity? Yeah, they bring in, I want that microphone, I want this kind of carpet, and I want, you know, that scent on the air, and then I'll be in my place. But most of these were done, we don't know, they were out of our control, right? A lot of this was done, files being sent.
Some, I mean, I think there was some were done here. Bobby Gillespie and James Murphy were done that way, that we sent them the chorus. Yeah. I think the others were here. I know Arrow from Starcrawler, she was a little uncomfortable. It's always difficult when you're doing quick sessions to assess when somebody's feeling safe, or they're just, it's a new situation, or they're just wondering who the hell I am and all that kind of stuff. So quick sessions are tough. And I, you know, when I moved to LA, I did a lot of pop sessions, and they are like blind dates. You never quite know what you're doing. And, you know, sometimes you don't get close to somebody. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you don't hit it off. But really to try and, it's hard to know if somebody is just weird. Some people are weird, you know, singers especially, or they're uncomfortable. Or I'm, you know, they don't like me, they don't like the studio. It's a lot, you know, having a bad day. It's difficult. And I don't want to say, are you having a bad day? It's probably not a great thing. But you want somebody to feel safe enough that they can try something out.
vocalists, we have two guest guitarists, and we have, let's see, oh, and we have, you know, people that you introduced us to, but for string arrangements and brass arrangements. But
Mary Latimer too, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah. But so vocalists maybe are a little trickier?
Well, they are. There's a lot, you know, I found vocalists to be really amazing people, because there's obviously some narcissism involved in it, and then there's crippling fragility, you know. And a lot of the things that people find weird about singers is like they're having this internal battle where they, you know, but it's like self-hatred, lacking confidence, and they have to protect themselves so they can come across as being quite difficult, when really it's such a bizarre job to do. When we're on stage, we're usually hiding behind something, you know, and we've got a drum kit, or we've got a guitar or a keyboard sound or something like that. So it's not actually us. I mean, we are making noise happen. But once you open your mouth, it's you. And then if you're writing words, then it's also you. Just, you know, you're trying to put meaning onto words and emotions and explain things. So it's a weird thing to do, and then you get the attention. So generally, you know, I always know if I meet a drummer, just because they have similar personalities, and they you know, they're standing at the back, and they have characteristics that are connected with each other. You know, there's generally very supportive and anchoring. You know, it sounds like a cliche, but it's true. It's not just the beat, but it's also the personality. Which is strange, because I think a lot of new bands are missing drummers. You know, they have programmers and things like that, so they're actually missing the personality rather, as well as the sound. They're missing the personality. But singers, they have a tough job, and you know, I expect them to try stuff out. And if they've never met me before, they don't know if I'm going to mock them or to, you know, make them sound bad. So when even from working with, say, Neil Diamond, who mistrusts producers anyway, because one of them took a hit out on him when he was younger, you know, so that's why he started carrying a gun. But he just thought I was there to fuck him up. So he knew that he needed me, but he didn't want me, and he didn't like me. He got to like me. His way of apologizing to me for being difficult with me was to put stones in my shoes. Anyway, well, I didn't wear shoes at the time, so when I go home, I put my feet in my shoes, and they'll be filled with stones. But, you know, my role is to try and get them to try something that I haven't tried before, or that they wish they could do, but hadn't been given the license or the support to do it. So I remember I started off when I worked with the band at Block Party. We were recording an album, and I said, okay, we got that done. Is there anything that you would really like to do, but you don't know if you could? And Kelly, the singer who you had in the show, said, you know, I really like, I listen to mostly hip-hop music. And, you know, we'd made a guitar record. So towards the end of it, he said, you know, I really want to do something that's somewhere between Peekaboo by the Banshees and One Thing by Amory. And I said, okay, well, why don't we just do it to see what happens? Just give it a few days. And we did a song, and it became the first single from that record. And then we ended, because it was so liberating to do this thing, work in this way, we then went back to all the recordings we had done and started playing with them, because we'd given ourselves license to do it. But it's really like those things, bands don't quite know, can we get away with this? And they don't know, and they don't have a conversation with each other. Like, secretly, they listen to, like you were saying, Robert listens to this kind of music, but he doesn't necessarily think, can we actually do this? So I try and find what those things are and do it. So when I was working with Two Door Cinema Club at first, I did the first record I did with them, we just recorded straight the way they wanted it, and that was fine. And then the second one, the singer, Alex, had a bit of a breakdown. You know, the band were overworked and forgot how to write songs. So we were trying to figure out how do you actually write a song. You couldn't remember how to do it. So I got this box that changed your gender, And it turned him into a kind of more of a higher pitched vocalist. And it enabled him to hide in the way he hid behind his guitar. He could hide behind this box. So he could say things a bit like Bono did with Mephisto. You can say things that, or a ventriloquist dummy, you can say things that you can't say. So once he started doing that, and then we took away the box, suddenly he felt, shit, I can do this. And I can be playful. I don't have to be earnest. I can try stuff on. Similar as you were saying with Robert and the Banshees, you know, I'm just going to try this, see how it feels. And once you get away with it, it just expands your world and your arsenal. And that's my job, I guess. For some people, it's not. They just document recordings, which is fine. I kind of want to try and find out what the person dreams of being.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.